Matrilinearnost. Jednu rastuče na konce, druga isplete mrežu, treća zahvati. Jedna na koži zareže godine, druga savije rešetke, treća istupi. Jedna pod jezik ušuška trn, druga uzgoji grlo, treća se usudi. Jedna ugrize kamen u ustima, druga proguta zube, treća pljune, progovori.
Matrilinearität. Eine wird zerrieben zu Fäden. Die nächste knüpft ein Netz. Die dritte wirft es aus. Eine ritzt die Jahre in ihre Haut. Die nächste biegt das Gitter. Die dritte tritt hinaus. Eine bettet den Dorn unter der Zunge. Die nächste hegt ihre Kehle. Die dritte wagt es. Eine beißt auf den Stein in ihrem Mund. Die nächste schluckt die Zähne hinunter. Die dritte spuckt aus, spricht.
Literaturpalast Audiospur. Geschichten aus Südosteuropa. Präsentiert von Traduki. Ich begrüße Sie ganz herzlich zu dieser Ausgabe der Audiospur, in der es, Sie ahnen es, um Lyrik gehen wird. Denn meine heutige Gesprächspartnerin, die bosnische Lyrikerin, Essayistin und Übersetzerin Selma Asotic, haben Sie eben schon zur Einstimmung gehört, und zwar mit dem Gedicht Matrilinearität aus dem Band Sag Feuer. Das Buch ist im Herbst 2025 in der Übersetzung von Marie Alpermann und Rebecca Zeinzinger im Surkamp Verlag erschienen. Die deutschsprachige Fassung hat die in Wien lebende Lyrikerin Frida Paris eingesprochen, deren Debüt Nachwasser im Frühjahr 2024 in der Edition Azur erschienen ist. Die Kombination von Feuer und Wasser schien mir doch sehr reizvoll. Hierfür lieben Dank. Sie werden im Verlauf dieser Folge auch noch ein, zwei weitere Gedichte hören. Selma Asotic lebt in den USA, uns trennen in diesem Moment 6 Stunden und ein Ozean. Digital sind wir jedoch verbunden und unser Gespräch werden wir auf Englisch führen. Selma, I'm very happy to have you. I've been talking to many guests living in other countries. You're the first one living on another continent. So thank you for making this happen and thanks for talking to me today. Hello.
Thank you, Tina. Thank you for the welcome. And I'm happy to be able to say hi across the ocean.
Und bevor wir ins Gespräch einsteigen, wie gewohnt, einige Informationen zu meiner Gesprächspartnerin. Danach geht's dann auf Englisch weiter. Selma Asotic wurde 1992 in Sarajevo geboren, studierte in ihrer Heimatstadt Komparatistik und gab von 2017 bis 2021 die hier erscheinende feministische Theorie- und Kunstzeitschrift Bona heraus. 2018 ging Asotic in die USA, um hier ihre Studien fortzusetzen. Ihren Master of Fine Arts machte sie an der Boston University. Aktuell ist sie Doktorandin an der University of Massachusetts Amherst. Seit vielen Jahren veröffentlicht sie Gedichte, Essays und Übersetzungen in unterschiedlichen Zeitschriften. Nennen möchte ich an dieser Stelle ihren Essay »Where the river takes me is none of my concern«, also »Wohin mich der Fluss treibt, ist mir völlig egal«, erschienen im Magazin Barricade. Den empfehle ich Ihnen für einen ersten Eindruck. Den finden Sie ganz einfach online und wir werden später sicher auch noch darauf zu sprechen kommen. Im Jahr 2022 erschien Asotics erste Einzelpublikation, ihr Debütband »Rezivatra«, auf Deutsch »Sag Feuer«. Für das Buch wurde sie mit dem Stepan-Gulin-Preis sowie mit dem Steffi-Zazweck-Preis ausgezeichnet. Der Gedichtband ist nun in der Übersetzung von Marie Alpermann und Rebecca Zeinzinger in der Edition Surkamp erschienen und das als zweisprachige Ausgabe, also bosnisch und deutsch. Dem Titel des Bandes haftet etwas Mythologisches an. Sag Feuer lässt sich als eine Art Anrufung oder Aufrufung einer höheren Macht oder Kraftquelle verstehen. Und tatsächlich setzt sich Asotic darin kritisch und feministisch mit zahlreichen Mythen und essentialistischen Vorstellungen auseinander. Der bürgerlichen Kleinfamilie, dem Nationalstaat, Heimat, Herkunft sowie dem Konzept der Muttersprache. Die 37 Gedichte des Bandes beschäftigen sich mit ganz unterschiedlichen Themen. Besonders auffällig ist jedoch die Auseinandersetzung mit Macht, Gewalt und den Folgen des Bosnienkrieges. Die Texte arbeiten mit Ironie, Wiederholungen, Vor- und Rückwärtsbewegungen, die nie zu einem Ende, zu einem Abschluss kommen. Das titelgebende Feuer zieht sich als Motiv durch viele Texte des Bandes, als Schüsse und Explosionen, Waldbrände und Scheiterhaufen, aber auch als scheinbar unschuldige Glühwürmchen oder als romantische Fantasien und sexuelles Begehren, wenn es heißt, ich suche eine Hand, in der ich verbrennen kann. Dies also ein wirklich sehr kleiner Einblick, mehr erfahren Sie dann gleich im Gespräch und dazu wechsle ich wieder ins Englische. Selma, before talking about Zach Feuer, I'd like to take a step back and talk about your time in Sarajevo, especially about your early interest in literature and writing. In your essay that I've already mentioned, Where the River Takes Me is None of My Concern, you talk about a trip to Sarajevo when you were already living in the U.S., and the essay deals with a lot of issues, and I will probably come back to it later on, but I'd like to start with a specific scene that I found very fascinating, the moment you discover an old writing journal of yours, and I quote, I discovered an old writing journal. A writing journal is not what I called it aged 10, because I had no concept of literature as something practiced. I flipped through the pages of rickety letters, poems, descriptions, the beginnings of short stories and novels. Having a journal like this at such a young age seems quite unusual, at least to me. Do you come from a family of avid readers or writers? Can you talk about your very early beginnings as a writer or as a writing person?
It's actually the opposite. I come from a family of one avid reader, my mother, mm-hmm. who was a big influence. I live in a household, which is common in Bosnia, where three generations lived under one roof. So my brother and I were the only children. My parents lived with us. And also we lived with our paternal grandparents, so the parents of my father. My grandparents were barely literate. My grandmother learned how to read and write when she was a young girl and had finished, I think, 4 grades of elementary school. And she was actually an exception because in the village where she grew up, I come from a Muslim family and Muslim girls were not sent to school. They were not educated. Her father made an exception and sent her to school. So she learned how to read and write. My grandfather became literate later in his life. He was a Yugoslav partisan, and after World War II, he joined a night school for factory workers. And I'm mentioning this because basically in our house, the only person with a college degree was my mother. And my mother had literary aspirations when she was younger, and she kept her own sort of literary journal. Journal is probably not a good word for it, but she had this little book where, as a young girl, she would cut out poems from magazines and put them there, or she would handwrite her favorite poems or her own poems. And actually, that's the first quote-unquote book that I read in my life. And that was my first, you know, moment of complete enchantment. But I'm mentioning my grandmother and my grandfather because even though they were, you know, not literary inclined, there was so much singing and storytelling happening all the time in our house, which is not rare in Bosnia or in the Balkans in general. It's you know, a culture that's steeped in song and storytelling. But when I was a kid, I would constantly be hearing my grandfather would be reading from the Quran. And he had this beautiful voice and the melody in Arabic, it's called a mekam. The way that he read was really beautiful. And then my grandmother would sometimes start telling us stories, myths and legends, or she would on occasion start singing these epic poems that from the oral tradition that she had learned as a child. And then in the evening, my mother would read to me and my brother at night to read us to sleep. So I sort of grew up in this environment that was full of melody and song. I wanted to write even before I knew how to write. I was just, you know, imitating the shape of the letters, and I was desperate to start writing. But when I learned how to read and when I fell in love with poetry, what I was looking for in poetry was the melody, not the meaning. I didn't care about the meaning in my house, we had a very small library that my mother had brought into the house when she married my father. It was, a few dozen books. But it was a very eclectic collection where you'd have anything from William Wordsworth to like Pablo Neruda and then the Yugoslav poets and writers. And so when I was 9 or 10, I would read Pablo Neruda. And of course, I didn't understand Pablo Neruda. I didn't understand this love poetry, right? But I didn't care because for me, what I was really responding to and what I was looking for is just the melody. You know, later on, I finally developed a consciousness of literature as something practiced, I then became preoccupied with other things. But in my development as a poet, I actually realized that my initial instinct was the right one because poetry is music, it is melody. And so that's really the very beginning. And so I was exposed to literature in its various shapes and forms very early on. And then when I was a kid, I just spent so many hours just reading and writing. As soon as I could, I think I learned how to read at the age of, even before I started going to school. I was just, left to my own devices and also left to my own imagination. And I think that sort of strengthened this impulse in me to activate my imagination and to build worlds and inhabit them. So I would say that those early experiences were very formative.
And speaking of the a concept of literature is something practiced. This developed because you just continued on reading and writing, or when you started, working on your poetry or having readings or publishing your first poems, how did that develop when you were younger?
When it comes to publishing, I'm a very late bloomer. Nothing in my literary career happened the way I expected it, imagined it. Everything took much longer and happened much later. So, and I've always struggled with publishing, with publication. As for writing, I remember being 9 years old, writing my first poem and telling my parents, I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to be a poet. And I was 9. And since then, that hasn't changed. That's the only certainty in my life. I always knew that I was going to be a poet. I started writing as soon as I learned how to write. And so from the age of 8, I think 9 was when I wrote my first poem. But before then, I tried writing like little fairy tales or these little stories or whatnot. And from the age of 8, all the way, like throughout my teenage years, I was just writing incessantly. But in those years, writing was an instinct, like a need that rises within you, and then you just feel that you need to write, or you hear these words in your head or these images form in your mind and you want to commit them to paper. There's just this deep impulse that you can't even defend against, that you just have to do it. And then when I was maybe 16, 17, sort of on the threshold of adulthood, that relationship starts to change. I think you lose touch with this primal connection that you have with the world. You lose touch with the inherent strangeness of childhood, the fact that, to a child's eye, the world is inherently strange, which lends itself wonderfully to poetry. And then as you grow older and as you mature, you have to find that strangeness in the world again. And you have to desensitize yourself to the things that you know. You have to learn how to look at the world again. And I think a big challenge for people later on, especially for poets, is to relearn how to truly look at the world as if you're seeing it for the first time. So when that happened, there was this very difficult moment for a couple of years in my life where I felt that I'd lost this deep connection that I had to poetry. And I was really suffering deeply because of this, because I thought that, it wasn't coming as easily and it wasn't as natural to me. And then the notion of craft comes in, the notion that what I'm doing is not just instinct. What I'm doing is not just an outpouring of emotion or images. What I'm doing is something with intent. And I have something to say, or I think I have something to say, and then I'm crafting it in a way that I want to. And I'm not saying that I didn't do that before. Like, you're writing and you're trying to craft something, of course, but this consciousness of the craft, of the effort, of what it means to write a poem is something that developed later. And I can't even say, for me, I think even though I've been writing, basically almost my whole life, I really only learned what it means to write a poem in my mid to late 20s after I'd enrolled in the MFA program for poetry at Boston University and then spent a year just studying poetry with other poets. And I think it's only then, after, you know, almost 20 years of writing poetry, that I realized, oh, this is what it means to actually write a poem. This is what it actually should be. This is the kind of work that goes into it. And then I started looking at everything that preceded that moment as a kind of practice, as an exercise, or as a like a preliminary stage to the real work that I think began then.
Okay, but looking at your biography, I just had the notion that probably during your time at Bonn or being a student in Sarajevo, you probably, because like here in Vienna, all the poets seem to know each other, they support each other, they work together. And in Sarajevo, it was probably similar, especially when you're so connected to a magazine. That probably also had some kind of significance for your writing.
Yes. Again, I'm a little bit of a strange case. For a very long time, I had this idea that I would just write and then somebody somewhere would just discover me and that would be it. I had no notion of a literary community. Mm-hmm. I had no notion of the literary industry. In my mind, what existed was the poetry. And when I was in college, I actually read very few contemporary poets. I hated contemporary poetry. I was mostly reading, you know, the modernists and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, call it the conceit of youth, right? You think you're above your mm-hmm. contemporaries because you're, you know, you're there reading T.S. Eliot or whatever. I mean, it's beyond preposterous and silly looking back on it. But that's kind of, you know, when you're young, you have these ideas that you're special. So I just was completely not, I didn't participate in any of this. So when I was a college student in Sarajevo, I was writing, but not publishing at all. I didn't even know what the journals were. I wasn't part of any, like, I was part of some groups, but not really like poetry and none of that. And my first publication, my first serious publication, when I was 17, my high school basically published like a volume of my early poems, but that little chap book wasn't, like, it wasn't sold in the bookstores. It wasn't available in bookstores. It was just something that the high school published and, you know, the kids in my class got it. And then they sent it off to some libraries and that was pretty much it. But I wouldn't really say that was me entering the literary world. But other than that, I had no publications. I hadn't published a single poem in any of the journals until the age of 22 or something. I don't even remember how old I was, but it was kind of towards the end of my college studies when finally I'd become aware of the literary industry. And my first publication, it's actually interesting because there was this literary journal that was run by students from the University of Sarajevo, from the what we call the School of Philosophy, which is where I studied English and comparative literature. It's called SICK. And they were notorious because it was a group of students at the university that basically just went to town, just ripping the entire literary establishment to shreds. They were very contrarian and they would write these like scorching reviews and excoriating essays, just criticizing mercilessly all of the holy cows of the intellectual and literary establishment. And like the biggest poets were just completely destroyed by these, you know, young college students. And so everybody was deadly afraid of this publication. And I had a friend who kind of knew this group of guys and girls who were working on it. And she said, you know what, I think you should send the poems to the editor. That was my first publication in this literary journal that was just like the scariest possible place where you could publish your poems. And it was my first publication. And then after that, my entry into the literary life mostly took place through meeting people, through meeting a person who is now a good friend of mine, Stacey Mattingly, who was running a writer's workshop in Sarajevo back then, getting into that workshop, meeting with other poets, you know, meeting translators, et cetera, et cetera. And then through that, you kind of, I got into, you know, these journals and started publishing my work. But I was as I said, I was a very late bloomer, mm-hmm. In that sense. It wasn't really until my mid-20s that I kind of, you know, started seriously publishing. And when you look at other poets of my generation, they're all on their like third and fourth books and whatnot. And I have this like single little volume of poetry at the age of, you know, 30 that I published. And it's something that for a few years I was kind of desperate to get this book out, and I didn't think it was going to happen. And I didn't really, I just got so many rejections and it just wasn't happening. And at that point I was desperate and I just really wanted it to happen as soon as possible. But now in hindsight, I'm so glad that things worked out the way they did. I'm so glad that it took time. I'm so glad that I was able to revisit and rework this manuscript. And if you compare the early versions of the manuscript with the book that we are now talking about, it's astronomically different. And I'm so happy that I didn't get what I want and that I didn't publish it when and how I wanted it, because it wouldn't have been as good as it is now.
So after this magazine in Sarajevo, nothing could scare you anymore.
That's true.
So you went to an even scarier place, the U.S.
And, that's true, yeah.
And speaking of industry, you found out late about this whole industry and market. And coming to the U.S., things are probably a bit different there, or the market plays a bigger role probably compared to Europe and Bosnia. And usually I get the impression that the literary scene in the US is very closely tied to academia. For example, all the translators I know work in an academic environment. Also, the expectations, what a writer does or shouldn't do or should do might be different. How did that affect you? I mean, you knew about the scene or the market, but coming to the US is something completely different, I guess.
Yes, it was quite a shock. And I have to say that it's still a shock. I've been living here for 6 years and I'm still in shock and continuously amazed by the society, mostly in very negative ways. It's only when I came to the U.S. that I realized that I'm a European, mm-hmm. thoroughly, I guess, or like an Eastern European to be precise. But on the one hand, it's very different. First of all, it's massive. I mean, it's just massive. The scale of it is just incredible. Everybody writes. There's so many things happening all the time. But on the other hand, it's kind of the same, where you have these institutions and you have the gatekeepers and it's a very small circle and you're either invited to the party or you're not invited to the party, you know? There's this myth that in the U.S., it's all about meritocracy, and if you're good, you get what you deserve. And that's not really the case. I actually find the society to be deeply corrupt in ways that are unimaginable. But I realized very early on that here as well, it's mostly about who you know and networking, as they call it here, you know, getting to meet all of these people. And what's different here is the enormous pressure to publish. And I think that pressure applies both to academia, if you're doing a master's program or a PhD. I think in Europe, people are more, you know, inclined to wait, which I think is a more natural inclination, because what the hell are you going to say in your second year of PhD studies, you know? And you are right, it's very much connected to academia, because you have this whole business of the MFA programs. And what's happening to the US literary scene is that there's this kind of professionalization of literature, where if you want to become part of this literary world, you have to get an MFA. And then through that MFA, you get other opportunities. But what also happens is that you do an MFA program, which is a kind of master's program, right? And you can choose poetry or prose or theater. What ends up happening is that everybody just ends up writing the same thing. Like everybody just ends up sounding the same. So it's this kind of straitjacket that's put on the world of literature, where you have these MFA programs that churn out poets that are very good in terms of craft. But poetry is not only craft, right? Just like art, any art, like you can be technically very good at playing the guitar or technically very good at painting, but it doesn't make you a great artist. For great art, you need something else other than craft. when I came here and then I, you know, I started reading all of these journals and keeping up with contemporary production. And at first it was a sense of novelty because I was exposed to a bunch of other voices, to a bunch of different ways of writing poetry, and the whole thing opened up in front of me. And I was very thankful for that. But very soon, when you see that everybody's kind of doing the same thing and everybody's kind of, you know, following these trends, you realize that it really is very trend-based, right? So there will be a kind of trend and everybody will jump on the bandwagon and sound exactly the same. And then there will be another trend and everybody will jump on that bandwagon. And I think here also marketing plays a big part, and it's how you market yourself and especially how you market different parts of your identity that play like a huge part. Suddenly I had to be going around telling people that I'm Eastern European and they had this expectation of what that means. Mm-hmm. And you know, coming from Bosnia, from the Balkans and surviving a war as a child and all of these things suddenly become something that I now need to like hawk, you know, goods or products at a market in order to get somebody to be interested in my poems, and the fact that I'm a woman or a lesbian and I come from Bosnia and whatnot, you know. So all of these points of my identity suddenly became something that people expected me to, I don't want to use the word weaponize, but kind of sell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And through that also kind of sell my poetry. So it all became quite disgusting very early on. And I actually think there's much more variety and experiment happening in places like, you know, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, the Balkans, where we don't have this professionalization to that degree. You have trends, of course, you always have trends, mm-hmm. but it's a little more chaotic in that sense. It's not as, you know, streamlined where they funnel you into these MFAs and then you get this degree, you learn what a good poem is supposed to be or what the fashion is, and then you reproduce it. And then everybody works with, you know, everybody wants to get published by the same journals and et cetera, et cetera. But I learned things that are just so important to me in that program. So I'm not, you know, trying to be hypercritical. I know that there are some negative sides to it. But for me, really, it was transformative. But yeah, the literary scene in the U.S. is very difficult. And I think this pressure to publish at one point was so debilitating for me and so paralyzing that at one point I stopped writing. I even stopped reading. Like I developed such an anxiety that I couldn't even read. So for a few months, I stopped reading, I stopped writing, and then it coincided with the pandemic. And then I went back home to Sarajevo after a very long time and sort of started writing again there.
Talking about writing here and there in the U.S. and in Bosnia, you also, when you were moving to the U.S., you also started writing in English, maybe even did so before, because as you said, you studied English as well. But you suddenly had to, yeah, you even had to, because of these programs, write in English. How did this affect your writing, also your writing in Bosnian? Because I think now you write in both languages, and I imagine you deciding what language to pick, and maybe you don't even pick just one, but write in the two languages. How does living in this English speaking environment, how does it affect, or did it affect, the writing?
Mm-hmm. So I started learning English very young. In Bosnia, we start learning English as a second language, mm-hmm. And then German also a little later. But English is it's very early. I was very comfortable in the language. And in Sarajevo, I was working as a translator and an interpreter and working with Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, and English. But I had never written poetry in English before then. I'd read poetry in English, but I'd never written it. And the first time I tried writing poetry in English was when I was compiling my application for these MFA programs in the U.S., and I needed to submit a sample. So I needed, you know, 10 to 15 pages of writing to send as a sample to these committees. And so that was the first time when I started experimenting with writing in English as a second language. And at first, it was very strange, very uncomfortable. I didn't really have a clear idea or like a clear sense of what I was doing. I didn't really feel that I was... I think when you're writing, and even when you're reading, which is why reading is also such a unique, wonderful experience, and why so many people identify themselves as readers. Because I think when you're reading, you get, and even if you don't write, I think this is a familiar state, that like you get into this state where you feel like you're inside the text in a way that's like, you know, you're sort of completely submerged in this thing, and you kind of feel it all around you and in you. And when I'm writing, I get into this like state of mind where you start writing, and at first you might be struggling, and then at some point you kind of feel that you're inside the text, like you kind of feel that you have it, and then it becomes a completely different prospect. And when I started writing in English, I just didn't have this feeling. I felt so removed from the text. I just felt that it was this external thing, something outside of me that I was working on, and not something coming from inside of me. And when I moved to the US, and now I had to, as you said, I had to write in English. Initially, I really, really struggled with this. I really struggled kind of entering these poems. And then, as I mentioned, as I wrote in the essay that you mentioned, "Where the river takes me is none of my concern," I then started to kind of take this distance, maybe like a blessing, and started to lean into it, because then it opened up like a new way of that distance, opened up some new things in me, and gave me some other images and points of view. And since then, I've been writing in both languages, and I really can't tell you, it's not a conscious decision that I make of like, oh, now I'm going to write in Bosnian, or now I'm going to write in English. I just kind of write, and I write words as they come to me. If they come to me in English, I write them in English. If they come in Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, I write them in that language. But for me, this has become the way that I write. Translation has become my writing method. And I was recently asked about the English version of the book. Somebody asked me about, you know, the translation. And I had to explain to people that, so this book, Say Fire, it exists in Bosnian, German, English, Macedonian for now, but in every form it exists, it's a translation. This book doesn't have an original version. It only has a version that was published first, and then the version that was published second, and then the version that was published third. But that doesn't mean that, for example, the English version is a translation of the Bosnian, because a lot of the poems in the Bosnian version are actually translations of the English, because mm-hmm. I wrote them originally in English. And then it also contains poems that I originally wrote in Bosnian and then translated it into English. And then, you know, the German translation is basically a translation of a translation, really. Mm-hmm. Translation is just part of the fabric of the work. It's not a process that happens subsequently or that comes after I write the original. In my case, there really is no original. I'm constantly sort of going back and forth between the two.
That's what I also wanted to ask, because I saw online that the English version just came out basically in October, I think. Right? Am I correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And it doesn't give you the name of a translator. So yeah, I wanted to ask you if you did it yourself, but now you explained how this happened. Yeah. So we should talk about the German version of your poetry collection. And I think before we do so, we should and want to listen to another poem from your book. Let's hear Niemand schreibt nach Hause, No One Writes Home. This is, maybe you can explain also, because there are, I think, four poems in your book with this specific title. And this is the fourth and last one. So it's kind of like a circle.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to make a little digression, but I will come back to your question. I mentioned before that it was only really in my mid to late 20s and after I'd been through this MFA program that I learned what it means to write a poem. And I also learned working on this book what it means to write a book of poetry. And a big part of writing, not a poem, but a book of poetry, is figuring out how to turn your weaknesses into your strengths. And if I had any advice for any writer or artist out there, that's what I would advise them. Figure out how to turn your weakness into your point of strength. What happened with this manuscript is that I printed out all of these poems. I laid them out on the floor. I was going through them and I was trying to identify these common gestures that I have and things that, you know, make up my writing style that maybe I wasn't particularly happy with. And the first thing that became evident is that I tend to repeat myself a lot. My first impulse was cut out the repetitions, cut them out, replace them with something else. And the more I tried to do that, it wasn't really working. And then I realized, well, wait a minute. If these poems individually and as a whole are constantly repeating things, maybe that's what this book is actually about. Maybe this book is actually about obsessive repetition. And so instead of trying to cut out what I thought was a weakness, I decided to sort of flip it and turn it into a structural element, a foundational element of the book. So I then basically structured the book as constant repetition, obsessive repetition. And these four poems, No One Writes Home, are placed in the book so that they kind of act as markers or very subtle dividers between sections, but they also propel the narrative forward. I'm using the word narrative here because there is a kind of narrative thread in the book. It's a story of like a poetic subject, of a poetic persona, and her coming of age and coming to accept a lot of things about herself and her history, both a personal history and the history of the place where she comes from. We write to find out something, to find out what it is that we know or don't know. So it's not about me saying what I already know. It's about me finding something out, me learning something. And I have this now thought in my mind that if you sit down to write and you have an idea in your mind or like a clear intent and you sit down with something to say, if you write a poem and that intent hasn't changed, nothing has moved in between, I think your writing process has failed. I don't think you have actually honored what the creative process could and should be. If you are the same poet, and if this idea is the same from inception to end, and nothing in the writing process has caused you to change or question or whatever, nothing has evolved, I don't think you were writing, I think you were transcribing. And so for me, for these poems, they actually started as these little vignettes and these little like images. And then I realized that there's an epistolary impulse in them. And so I started to address, at first the person addressed in these poems was my brother. But as I was working on the poems and I was working on the collection as a whole, I realized that my interlocutor, that the person that I'm speaking to is my mother. And that this is a relationship or this is a book about mothers and daughters. And that this is its like main structural element. But I found that out through constant work. And so this is the fourth of the four epistolary poems, No One Writes Home in the English. And I think you've shared the German title. And it ends the book. So I'm going to read it in Bosnian Croatian Serbian. Niko ne piše kući. Nešto se stalno slama na nebu iznad nas. Pokušavam se sjetiti svitaca u tvojim sklopljenim rukama. Kasni august. Na našoj koži ljeto nije znalo kako odustati. Okliznula sam se trčeći za tobom, već zamaklom sa druge strane brda, gdje mrtva usta vojnika makovima šapuću tajne korijenja. Trčala sam, vjerujući rijeci kad bi slegnuši talasima zamijenila naše odraze, kroz dan pun drači, ne sluteći koliko daljine stane u jedan oželjek. Sad znam, čim se oblak prelomi, nahrupi plavet da ispuni prazninu. Nebo je tek glasina o svemu što smo izgubili. Gdje god da pogledam, tvoja sjena još nestaje za horizontom. I ja još trčim prema tebi, širom otvorenih ruku, trčim unazad, uvijek, mama.
Niemand schreibt nach Hause. Etwas bricht ständig am Himmel über uns. Ich versuche mich an das Glühwürmchen in deinen gefalteten Händen zu erinnern. Ende August. Auf unserer Haut konnte der Sommer noch nicht aufgeben. Ich rutschte aus, als ich dir nachrannte. Du warst schon hinter dem Hügel, wo tote Soldatenmünder den Mohnblumen Wurzelgeheimnisse zuflüstern. Ich rannte, dem Fluss vertrauend, wenn er mit den Wellen zuckte und unsere Gesichter vertauschte, rannte durch einen Tag voller Unkraut, nicht ahnend, wie viel Ferne in eine Narbe passt. Jetzt weiß ich, sobald eine Wolke bricht, stürzt Blau herein und füllt die Leere. Der Himmel ist nur ein Gerücht über alles, was wir verloren haben. Überall, wohin ich sehe, schwindet dein Schatten noch am Horizont. Und ich renne dir noch entgegen mit ausgebreiteten Armen. Ich renne rückwärts, immer, Mama.
You see, I always thought, or while reading it, I was thinking it's some kind of conversation or even letter to a mother. Maybe just, you see, the last poem ends with Mama, so maybe just an easy thought. But you also talked about the structure and arrangement of the books, of how it's so much different to write a book of poems compared to just writing one poem. And I want to dive in even further into structuring this book. You called it a kind of coming of age story, or a kind of journey for this figure that is not the narrator, but that is kind of in the center of many of these texts. So would you say, maybe this is a dull question, but would you recommend reading it from the beginning to the end, or maybe it doesn't even matter that much?
Yeah, so you need to read it from beginning to the end on like a very gray, rainy day when you have nothing else to do.
That's what I did.
That's exactly how you should do it. And you need to read it in one sitting.
Okay, I had two.
You can't come back to it. I think it's a book that kind of has to be absorbed in one sitting. So if you follow my instructions, I think you'll get the most out of it. But
okay.
Yes, I would prefer that people read it from beginning to end. That's kind of how I read poetry in general. I hate skipping through the book. But for sure, yeah, because there is this kind of arc or development, and it's subtle. I'm not saying that it's overt, but it's definitely there, and you have the book has different parts and different preoccupations, different themes. And then you have these four poems that serve as, you know, these little markers that kind of split the book into different sections. And then there's this little prose piece there as well. And I don't know if the German edition, in the German edition, it's this little text about my uncle. In the Serbian edition, we broke it up into several pieces. And in the Bosnian edition, it was published as just one piece.
Okay, we have different pieces, because that's why I wanted to ask, because you talked about a narrative. We heard that it's a kind of story, mm-hmm. but you also use prose in the book, and they're usually connected to some of the poems. I just wasn't sure that it's one mm-hmm. prose piece, because it's broken apart.
Yeah, so that was really a decision that came from Marija Draganić, who was the editor of the Serbian edition of the book. She had the idea of breaking it up and sort of interspersing it throughout the book, which I think was a great, great idea. And I like that solution. And it's like that in the English version as well. But yes, there's this little prose piece. And that was one of the few things that I actually managed to publish in the U.S. before the publication of the book. And when I published it here, it was published in Michigan Quarterly Review, this literary journal, and it was labeled as a lyrical essay.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I published it in Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, it came out in a Croatian literary journal, and it was labeled as a prose poem. And I don't really care much for these distinctions, but it is prose, right? It's not a traditional poem. And people have asked me, why did you write this as a prose poem? And I really don't have an answer to that question. I think I just needed, that's just how it came to me. And I think I needed like a longer breath to tell that story, and prose was better suited for it. But I like the decision to break it up into several pieces, because then each piece individually serves as a kind of vignette.
Mm-hmm.
And then together they also come together as like a full piece.
It also made me think of the books of Vagina Mort, because mm-hmm. she also combines prose and poetry in her books. She's also somebody that writes in her Belarusian and in English mm-hmm. and mixes things up. That's probably the reason why I had to think of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I'm not going to ask you why you wrote it in prose, but I will ask you about this sentence that is gets repeated. So war es nicht. That's not how it was. That's you find the sentence a couple of times. And I was just wondering why the sentence comes up, because it's kind of, it gives you the idea of history or memory as something that is not written in stone or not irrevocable. Is that a word? Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's about history for sure, and who gets to tell it and from what point of view it's told, which is what the book is concerned with to a great degree. On a more personal level, it's about my uncle and this family tragedy. It's a spoiler alert, but it's about my uncle who committed suicide. And yeah, when I started writing that text, the beginning of it, the start of it came into my mind, and these images. And when I wrote those images, I thought to myself, you're not actually describing the event. You're not actually saying what happened. And so I just wrote that. I was kind of thinking out loud to a degree. And so I just wrote, like, that's not how it happened. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try again. And so the text is really me thinking out loud to myself, this is inadequate. That's not how it happened. But the reason why it stayed in the text is that this refrain, that's not how it happened, I think also serves as a reminder that there is a kind of deep solitude, I think, in every human being, like a core within us that is untouchable or unreachable to anybody else but us. And I think the reason why I started writing poetry when I was very young is because as a child, I felt I had this deep feeling of my own solitude, which to me was a beautiful thing. I wasn't sad about it. I thought it was a wonderful thing. But I also had this acute sense that between me and other people in the world, there was this chasm that could not be bridged. And so I started writing poetry in a kind of desperate attempt to bridge this gap and to say what is inherently unutterable. And I think that it's like an itch that you can't scratch, this sort of desperate attempt at communication, at sort of establishing a connection between two human beings. And when my uncle committed suicide, there were so many explanations for why he did it. He did it in public on the street. And so, you know, the media jumped on it and they wrote about it in a very sensationalist way. And the fact that he was an army veteran, he had participated in the Bosnian War, that became a thing that, you know, they repeated in these news articles. And so suddenly, and then people would comment, you know, because this was published online. And then suddenly everybody had a story and a version of events. And looking at all of these versions, I kind of felt that we can hypothesize all we want and can create all kinds of narratives, but it doesn't really do justice to this human being who carried something within himself that only he knew. So I think this refrain, that's not how it happened, also became a way to honor this person and also to sort of wrest his death away from all of these narratives. I felt that it was a way of kind of honoring his privacy and the fact that, you know, he died in a very public way and death is a very intimate thing. And I wanted to return that intimacy and maybe a sense of sacredness to this moment that I felt was, because it was public, it was also kind of devalued and made trivial by everybody chiming in with their own interpretations and their own reactions to it.
I wanted to ask about the importance of war, especially the Bosnian War, in your poetry, but maybe you even answered the question already, talking about the uncle, because what you make clear throughout the book, also the sentence, it never stops, es hört nie auf, that the war touches on every aspect of life, the political, the private, the social life, and you can find it basically in most of the poems of your book, probably. I can't really make a question out of this.
But I think I know what you mean. And I've mentioned this many times before that I really never envisioned war becoming a theme in my poetry. And it's I never wrote about the war. You know, I mentioned that I've been writing since I was nine, and I spent my teenage years, my whole like young adulthood just writing incessantly. Never did the war come up as a topic, right? And so I just thought, this is not my topic. This is a topic of people who participated in the war or people who remembered it. I was an infant, a toddler. It doesn't affect me. I don't even remember it. I mean, I remember a few things. But then the older I got, the more I thought about it. And I've spoken about this with my friends who are the same age as I am. You know, we are all the same generation. And now most of us are in the age that our parents were in when the war started. And I think there's something about, like, you know, when you get into your late 20s and when you turn 30 and when you realize that, like, oh, my mother was 30 and had two kids when the war started, suddenly you can see yourself in that situation. And something that as a child you kind of just took as, it was just my life, my experience, you know. We grew up surrounded by minefields, and it was just my childhood. Like, you don't think that it's strange, or you don't have a sense of it being particularly extreme or strange. And it's only when you step, I remember the first time I went to Germany, I went to this, like a little writing camp near Berlin, and there were people from all over Europe there, and we were all hanging out and talking. And I remember my friend and I, the people would ask us questions about Bosnia, or they would ask us questions about Sarajevo and our childhood. And then we'd started to speak and talk about our experiences. And then there's always this moment in a conversation with somebody outside of the Balkans where you're talking about your life. Of course, you start mentioning things, you know, from your childhood. And then there's this moment where you see on the face of the person that you're talking to, this like sudden moment where they kind of, there's something in their face, like a reaction that makes you realize that what you're saying is completely insane. And it's only then that you realize that it is insane, right? Like, not everybody grew up riding their bicycles through minefields. It's not a common human experience. Talking to somebody from, you know, Western Europe or the US or wherever, like from parts of the world that thankfully have been spared these experiences, there's this moment that it's only through their reaction that you realize that you probably sound like a crazy person. And that's also how you feel. You feel kind of like a crazy person talking about something that they can't even imagine. And then when it happens often enough, you actually start to revisit some of your memories and some things. And I don't even know how and why I started writing about the war. I think when I came to the US and I was in this MFA program, and it was a personal thing. I started writing about my father. And I think I started writing about the war because I realized that I could no longer avoid this topic, because I realize that it is my topic and it does affect me. It actually affects so many things in my life. It affected my anxiety. It affected my panic attacks. It affected my relationship to food. It affected, you know, some of my coping mechanisms. It affected some of my fears. Like, it affected everything. And it also affected members of my family. It also affected our lives in just very deep ways. Yeah, it's something that I realized that I would always return to. And especially now, you know, becoming an adult and having friends who are now having kids and starting families. And every time we meet, and we're only now kind of processing this period. And it feels like we will never sort of finish unwrapping it and talking about it. And so I started talking about it through my poetry because I realized that it was this theme that I was kind of avoiding, and that I really needed to finally confront it and face it and not run away from it any longer.
We have to come to an end, and I wanted to ask you one last question. If this question doesn't work out, I will ask you a different question, because maybe I'm on the complete wrong path. We talked about repetition. We talked about things not ending. It seemed to me there is some kind of strange movement in your book that I can't really describe, a kind of circular movement, a kind of going back and forth, but never really landing where you want to go. And Your book ends with this nobody writes home, and then the last passage it says, and I read the German, und ich renne dir noch entgegen mit ausgebreiteten Armen, ich renne rückwärts immer, Mama. So this movement of running but looking into a different direction, it kind of made me think of Walter Benjamin and the Angel of History, but I don't know, maybe I'm completely wrong here, but that's what came to my mind.
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. I think that's spot on. And I wasn't actively consciously thinking about Benjamin when I was writing it, but the cover of the English edition of the book, I love the cover because it has this weird bird on it that my publisher chose. And the bird kind of reminds me of the Angel of History, right?
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And I think it's such a good fit for this book. And I feel that I also have to, in addition to Benjamin, I have to bring in James Baldwin because he has that famous, James Baldwin is one of my favorite writers, but he also has that famous quote of, I have to pull it up now because I'm blanking on the full quote, but about nothing can be overcome until it is faced, right? I'm butchering the exact quote, but it's this notion of trying to go forward, but also constantly looking back, not in a nostalgic way, but looking back in with like a determination to actually confront yourself and your history. That's a big theme in the book. And I think this is what that image at the end of the book of constantly sort of looking back, or I also have this line in one other poem of my head being screwed on backwards, where history is always something that like it's there and you can't shake it off and you can't, you're always inside of it. And you always have to face it. You have to face it and confront it directly.
Selma, thank you for talking to me. We might see each other next year in Vienna, because I read that you get the Friederike Marücker residency at Literatur aus Wien, right? I think you'll come to Vienna next year.
Yes, very surprisingly, I did, and I am coming to Vienna in May, and I'm looking forward to it. The last time I was at a residency in Vienna was for the Museumsquartier, the Q21, and I had a wonderful time. Vienna is one of my favorite cities. I think you've heard this from other Bosnians. People in Vienna are probably sick of us, but we do love the city. We're there all the time. There's a lot of us there. So
everyone loves Vienna, not only people from certain countries.
But we especially, you know. But I am looking forward to it. And it's just a place that I really, really love. And I'm looking forward to returning to the city. I feel like that city gave me a lot, both personally and professionally. And I feel that now with this book out, I can also like give something back, maybe a little bit.
Looking forward to it. And thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you so much, Tina. I really enjoyed it. Bye.
Yay.
We're done?
We're done.
Excellent.